Hey everybody, I'm Kelly Jones, and this is Pioneer Radio. So you've probably realized this by now, Pioneer Radio is a pre-recorded radio show. We don't come to you live every week. We produce, record, and edit everything in advance, although I'm currently sitting in the studios making sure that this goes to air with as few glitches as possible. Hey, future Kelly, don't forget to grab milk on your way home. Does that sound like cheating? Pre-recording everything? Well, it's not. It's pretty standard in talk radio, actually. In fact, there's so much affordable hardware and software out there these days, it's no wonder that everyone and their cousin seem to be podcasting about something or other. You should give it a try. Why am I telling you this? The editing software we use at Pioneer Radio is called, get this, Hindenburg. My first thought was, why the heck would you name software after something that was famous for crashing? Luckily, there are smarter people on this radio team than me, and they pointed something out. Yes, Hindenburg Systems, the wonderful people that make our editing software, named their company after one of the most famous disasters. But it was also one of the most famous moments in radio history. When the Hindenburg went down, the journalist that covered the horrific scene, that you'll hear about later, shouted, "Oh, the humanity!" into the microphone. A new phrase was born, and with it, the dawn of a radio era. So in honor of that phrase, and in honor of the radio legacy that makes our show possible, with the addition of some spiffy software, this week's theme is, oh, the humanity. Stick with us.
And now a look at how something spoken spontaneously, in the heat of the moment, so to speak, almost 80 years ago, has become a stock phrase in popular culture.
Once, twice, three times a lady.
What the hell was that? Double bucket.
Did you get that? Well, if you were a Seinfeld fan back in the 90s, you'll know that that was the end of the pothole episode where Newman's driving a postal truck full of fresh fish and it runs over a sewing machine and bursts into flames and, well, maybe you had to be there. But maybe you might remember this better.
Pull over before somebody gets hurt.
Come on, Ducky!
That was Homer Simpson driving a blimp. The chief was in a blimp as well and tried to pull him over, and his blimp crashed. So what do those two clips have in common? Well, let's play one more, shall we?
All aboard Excelsior!
God, who'd want to put a bomb on that?
Well, that's what we're hoping ISIS can find out.
No, why bother? Some broad gets on there with a staticky sweater and boom, it's...
Oh, the humanity!
No, that's...
Sterling, were you watching some other blimp commercial just now?
That's from the FX series Archer, and now you get it, right? Oh, the humanity. But you'd have to be pretty old, well, older than me anyway, to remember the episode that made Oh, the Humanity famous. It happened back in 1937, and it was said by a radio broadcaster, Herbert Morrison. Morrison and his engineer, Charlie Nelson, had been sent to Lakehurst, New Jersey, to cover the arrival of the German airship Hindenburg for radio station WLS in Chicago. The Hindenburg had made this flight from Frankfurt several times, and by 1937 it had become a fairly routine event. This time, though, what happened was far from routine. on the evening of Thursday, May the 6th, as the airship approached the landing field and attempted to secure a mooring, it suddenly burst into flames. And here's how that sounded on air.
The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it. It burst into flames. Wait, get it started. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring bed. All the folks could see that this is terrible. This is the worst of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the passengers screaming around me. I don't ever talk to people whose friends are on there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen.
Of the 36 passengers and 61 crewmen, 13 passengers and 22 air crewmen died. One ground crewman was also killed. It's generally thought of as one of the first and most dramatic examples of live on-air reporting, but in fact, Herbert Morrison and his engineer had no facilities with them for on-air broadcasting. The event was recorded on 16-inch discs and then flown back that night to Chicago and played in full later that evening. Portions of the broadcast were replayed the next day by the NBC radio network. The newsreel footage we have of the disaster was filmed separately by several newsreel companies, and later that was combined with Morrison's voiceover. There's an urban legend, well, there's a lot of urban legends about the Hindenburg disaster, but one of them is that Morrison was fired by WLS for being so emotional on the air. But in fact, management praised him for his behavior, and he went on to have a long and relatively distinguished career both in broadcasting and in teaching. The crash of the Hindenburg was the most famous airship disaster, but it wasn't actually the worst. 4 years earlier, more than twice as many people died when the USS Akron crashed at sea off the New Jersey coast on the 4th of April, 1933. But there were no cameras or microphones to record that event. So it's the Hindenburg that we remember. And it's the crash of the Hindenburg that ended the era of passenger airships. But it gave us a whole new stock phrase for anything really horrific, or anything really horrific that we want to parody. Now, my own personal favorite is this one. It's the Thanksgiving turkey drop episode of WKRP in Cincinnati, and here's how that sounded.
And I think I hear something now. The crowd is moving out into the parking area, and, oh yes, I can see it now. It's a helicopter, and it's coming this way.
A helicopter?
It's flying something behind it. I can't quite make it out. It's a large banner, and it says, Happy Thanksgiving from WKRP. What a sight, ladies and gentlemen. What a sight. Seems to be circling the parking area now. I guess it's looking for a place to land. No, something just came out of the back of the helicopter. It's a dark object. Perhaps a skydiver plummeting to the earth from only 2,000 feet in the air. Second, the third. So no parachutes yet.
Those happy skydivers. I can't tell just yet what they are, but...
Oh, my God, they're talking! Crashing to the earth right in front of us. One just went through the windshield of a parked car. It's terrible. The cars running around pushing each other. Oh, my goodness. Oh, the humanity. People are running about. The turkeys are hitting the ground like sacks of wet cement. I don't know how much longer the crowd is running for their lives. I think I'm going to step inside. I can't stay out here and watch this any longer. No, I can't go in there.
Tragedy has never been anything like this.
As Mr. Carlson, the station manager, said in something that has also become kind of a stock phrase for some of us, as God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly. Oh, the humanity.
Oh, the humanity. The words are spoken by radio announcer Herbert Morrison as he witnessed the crashing of the Hindenburg in New York in May 1937. 36 people died. As I pondered his words for this program, I was reminded of something else. Where had I come across a similar idea before? Once again, and to the books. I have more than a dozen bookcases at home and thousands of books. It's an obsession. Fortunately, I was pretty sure I knew where to look. I went to Shakespeare's collected works. I have 6 versions of the collected works. Did I mention an obsession? I zeroed in on The Tempest. I've read the play many times. Act 1, Scene 2. Miranda and her father, Prospero, have been marooned on their island for most of Miranda's young life. The scene begins with Miranda saying, "Oh, I have suffered with those that I saw suffer. A brave vessel, who had no doubt some noble creatures in her, dashed all to pieces. Oh, the cry did knock against my very heart. Poor souls, they perished." And no, she wasn't talking about the Hindenburg. She was talking, of course, about a shipwreck off the island that launches the play. But take those lines alone, and making allowances for Shakespeare's language, and she might be echoing Herbert Morrison on the radio in New York in 1937. Right down to that plaintive O that begins the lines, "Oh, I have suffered. Oh, the humanity." Or was Morrison echoing Miranda? Whichever way it worked, I felt some satisfaction in tracking down the source of the echo. And then I thought about what I was doing. Why had I felt compelled to track down the reference in the first place, apart from some literary geekiness? And then I thought, I do this a lot, looking up fictional counterparts to real-life events. I have a need to make sense of life through literature and literary coincidence, and I'm not alone. With me is Toronto writer Ayelet Sabari. This spring, Ayelet published her debut collection of short stories with HarperCollins called The Best Place on Earth. She's been busy since then. This summer, an essay she published about her mom in Grain magazine won silver at the Western Magazine Awards. She also wrote recently about her father in Room magazine and published an essay about writing in Event magazine's summer issue. Welcome, Ayelet.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
So, let's start with an example or two of your own of how you've found real life echoing or mirroring fiction. Not necessarily your own, but perhaps. Ways in which real life echoes or mirrors fiction.
Okay. Recently I found two examples of real life mirroring art, or maybe art mirroring real life, in my own work. I wrote a story called Invisible, in which a grandmother, a Yemeni elderly woman, gives a ring, a precious ring, to her Filipina caretaker that her husband had made in Yemen. And about a year later, I found out that my own grandmother, who had passed away years ago, actually had given a ring to her Filipina caretaker that my grandfather had made.
And you didn't know this?
I didn't know that. Now, my husband immediately said, maybe you knew it on some level. Maybe you heard that story before, but I'm quite certain that I didn't. And moreover, it was important that it was a ring for the progress of the story. There's something happened that the ring is involved, which is why it wasn't a bracelet or a necklace, say. So that was a bit unnerving when that happened. And then on another occasion, I wrote a story called Brit Milah, where a woman comes to visit her daughter in Toronto after the daughter gives birth to a boy. And she gives her daughter a gift, a khamsa, which is a palm-shaped amulet to hang over the baby's crib. I wrote that before I was pregnant, before I had a baby. And then a couple of years later, my mother comes to visit me in Toronto after I give birth to a baby girl. And she opens her suitcase and hands me a khamsa to hang over the baby's crib. Again, people who heard that story said to me, but maybe that's what Israeli mothers do. And maybe they do, but I've never known my mother to do that with any of my siblings, nor have I heard of another woman doing that. So that I found quite eerie, actually, to the point that I began to worry that it wasn't just coincidental, but prophetic. I started to worry about what I should or shouldn't write in my writing, worrying that it may actually come true. I think there's two different things. There's the coincidence, where something so like a specific moment, you know, that is echoed in someone's work, or someone's, you know, a moment in someone's work that is echoed in your own life. But there's also that feeling of another character or an author speaking uniquely to you, and that is an experience I've had many times with literature. Like the emotion that comes through the writing,
yes.
That you can relate to, and this is a bit different than just a coincidence, you know. That's I don't know how to call that, really.
There's something more to it than just two things lining up.
Yeah.
And you look for meaning, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
So in the two instances that you described, mm-hmm. what's the meaning?
that's the thing I find with coincidence in life, in general. I find them both comforting and mystifying. Mystifying because you find yourself wondering why, what does it mean? But comforting because it's almost as if there's some guidance or a plan. It makes us feel a little bit less alone, I think, as if someone directed us in toward that work of art. For what reason, I'm not sure. But yeah, that's how I feel generally in coincidences in my life. You know?
Perhaps that relates then to another question. Writing is a mirror in which readers find themselves. Those are words that you have used yourself. Mm-hmm. Alberto Manguel in A History of Reading says, the world echoes a book. So is writing a mirror or an echo, a kind of fictive world that contains things that will come to pass in our real world? And if so, where are the portals or the doorways that connect them? Is it an individual writer like Ayelet Sabari who knows where the doors are?
I love that you use the word doors because I started thinking about it and I realized that it's a mirror, but it's a mirror door. and maybe it's a revolving door. Okay, so when I was speaking about, you know, it becoming a mirror, I was actually referring to the act of reading. The writer may be writing for, you know, in the way that you described, the writer may be writing, creating an imaginary world, a fictive world, but the reader reads to find themselves. And that's when it becomes a mirror in which they see themselves, because they're looking for it. I think that's probably the reason we read. We want to feel something. And they will find themselves, even if it's a very intangible connection, not something, you know, like the coincidence I mentioned before, something a lot more intangible.
For me, these ideas reaffirm the importance of words and books, literature as things that are alive in the world.
Yeah.
In his book, Why Read?, Mark Edmondson writes, the ultimate test of a book is the difference it would make in the conduct of life. What are your own thoughts as a writer and reader? Why does any of this matter?
Well, let's speak about reading first. I think reading experiences of other characters, trying to find, seeking yourself in works of art, and seeing yourself in those works of art creates empathy, creates compassion, and we help create and foster and promote empathy in the reader.
You've gone to find Laurie Moore.
Mm-hmm.
Birds of America?
Yeah. It's a book of short stories.
And what have you found in there?
It's a quote from a story titled, People Like That Are the Only People Here. It's a story I love and admire. And in it, she says, but this is the kind of thing that fiction is. It's the unlivable life, the strange room tacked onto the house, the extra moon that is circling the earth unbeknownst to science.
And that says to you what?
It's, I loved when you were asking, is it an imaginary world? And I like the idea that it's not just an imaginary world, but it's sort of parallel. It's existing parallel to our lives, this strange room tacked to the house. And I really do feel that way about my own fiction. It exists, you know, still. It's not like I let go of it when I finish writing it. It feels like those lives exist.
Do you feel that you actually cross into some other, that other world then?
Yeah.
And do you encounter other writers in that world? I'm imagining that world really exists out there.
Yeah.
And all the writers are finding themselves in that world somehow. And do you bump into others?
No, I don't.
Do you suppose that it's the same world for all?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I think it's, I think every writer is carrying their own other world.
In his book, Reading Life, Books for the Ages, Sven Burkertz calls Mrs. Ramsey, from Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse, a profound presence in his life. An interesting way to refer to a made-up character. Burkertz ends that discussion with these words, and I'm quoting here, sometimes I think that the long-term work of reading is to discover, one by one, the books that hold the scattered elements of our nature. What do you make of that?
So I feel like what he's saying is that we build our life in books, which is lovely, but also we sort of select the books that resonate with us, the books that where we find ourselves.
Finding ourselves and others. It's more than pursuing literary coincidence that sends me back to the books. I'm looking for a connection, meaning, maybe a way to feel a little less alone, knowing that someone else has marked this ground in works of imagination. There's comfort in that. Several years ago, I spent a weekend in hospital with a suspected heart attack. False alarm, as it turned out, but they had to run me through a bunch of tests to make sure. Ultrasound, angiogram, the works. I sat one afternoon, alternately staring out the window at Grey December and reading a collection of stories by Flannery O'Connor. One story is called The Life You Save May Be Your Own. At one point, one character says to another, "There's one of these doctors in Atlanta that's taken a knife and cut the human heart out of a man's chest and held it in his hand and studied it like it was a day-old chicken, and lady, he don't know no more about it than you or me." Well, maybe I felt less comfort in having read those words, but at least I felt a little less alone.
Author's note. In this book, I try to connect our progress towards discovering the physical basis of reality with our own character as human beings. My goal is to celebrate our ability to understand the universe, to recognize it as something that can draw us together, and to contemplate what it might mean for our future. Our science and our humanity are two sides of the same coin. Together, they are the means for us to live up to the opportunity of our existence. Today, we live in a worried world that seems short of good ideas. We are confronted by challenges that can feel overwhelming: financial instability, overconsumption and pollution, energy and resource shortages, climate change, and growing inequality. All of these problems were created by humans, and they are all solvable. Yet we seem to be locked in a culture of short-term thinking, of the quick fix and the fast buck, whereas what each of these problems really needs for its solution is consistent, principled, far-sighted actions extending over many years. We're reaching the limits of existing technologies and natural resources. We are in danger of losing our sense of optimism. Can we find smarter ways to manage our planet? Can we make the discoveries that will open up a bright future? Who are we, after all? Are we just the production of a process of random mutation and natural selection, now reaching its terminus? Or are we potentially the initiators of a new evolutionary stage in which life may rise to a whole new level? The human mind holds these ideas in the balance: how we live together, who we are, and how we place ourselves within reality. Our conceptions greatly exceed any immediate need. It is almost as if the evolutionary process has an anticipatory element to it. Why did we evolve the capacity to understand things so remote from our experience, when they are seemingly useless to our survival? And where will these abilities take us in the future? What is coming is likely to be even more significant than any past transformation. We've already seen how mobile communications and the World Wide Web are opening up a global society, providing information and education on a scale vastly larger than ever before. And this is only the beginning of how our new technologies will change us. So far, our scientific progress has been founded on, but also limited by, our own physical nature. We are only able to comprehend the world in a classical picture. This has been an essential stepping stone in our development, but one that we need to move beyond. As our technological capabilities grow, they will drastically extend our abilities, our experience of the world, and, in time, who we are. As we look ahead, our goal should be to experience, to understand, and to be part of the universe's development. We are not merely its accidental byproducts. We are the leading edge of its evolution. Our ability to explain the world is fundamental to who we are and to our future. Science and society's mission should be one and the same. Engraved on Karl Marx's tombstone are these famous words: "The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it." Riffing on a quote attributed to Gandhi, I would say, "The point, however, is to be the change." An excerpt from Neil Turok's The Universe Within.
The ship wherein Theseus and the youth of Athens returned from Crete had 30 oars, and was preserved by the Athenians down even to the time of Demetrius Phalereus, for they took away the old planks as they decayed, putting in new and stronger timber in their place, insomuch that this ship became a standing example among the philosophers for the logical question of things that grow, one side holding that the ship remained the same, and the other contending that it was not. This is Plutarch's record of the famous paradox of the ship of Theseus. A whole, broken down and repaired, slowly recomposed of replacement parts, eventually made of entirely new matter. We may ask this question of a ship or a house or other objects, but what of a person? What of that time that may shortly be upon us when we may replace a limb, a heart, an eye? Where is the continuity of the human being disrupted? When we remake ourselves, will we cease to be that which we were? But I'm getting ahead of myself. I meant to start off with flying cars. Perhaps correlated to my not learning to drive until I was in my mid-20s, the creation of the flying car was never my most anticipated piece of speculative technology. While my friends wondered aloud about the potential for hovering vehicles dotting the sky, I was likewise intrigued, but there was another promise of science fiction that I found most exciting. I was always waiting for the next iteration of another piece of machinery: the human body. Now, it's probably worth noting that I was a shy, skinny kid, all elbows and knees, as they say. I was acutely conscious of my alien limbs, always knocking objects off tables, tripping over themselves, or making me look ludicrous in shorts. I was athletically subordinary, lacking the strength and speed of my more prodigious playmates. It is little wonder, then, that the idea of mechanical or biological enhancement seemed like the most exciting promise of the sci-fi prophets who graced the Saturday morning television screen. As a child of the 80s in Canada, I was exposed to two iconic pieces of cultural imagery that further fed this interest in the techno-human boundary. First was Terry Fox, that heroic symbol of human drive, instantly recognizable by his prosthetic leg and distinctive gait, tirelessly pushing on across the continent. And given his annual celebration, it truly felt as though he had never stopped running. To young eyes, Fox was a kind of proto-cyborg, not disabled, but improved. His prosthesis, a now ancient piece of technology, was a potent symbol of resiliency and looked fairly futuristic for a kid of my age. The second image is less famous, but holds a special place in the hearts of many members of my generation. It was a Waramps television spot featuring an acrobatic metal child, Astar, leaping through a still shockingly well-visualized alien landscape of deadly machinery, twisting and diving between giant pistons and gears. Astar served to remind children that while he could put his arm back on after it was severed by a massive rotating blade, we could not and should play safe. This was potent fuel for a burgeoning imagination, and I often found myself dreaming of being able to replace parts of myself with stronger, faster, more durable bionic pieces.
What if he could be more than the man he was? We have the technology to rebuild him. I want it done no matter what the cost.
He's the man!
As a very young child, I failed to appreciate that prosthetics like that worn by Fox were given at great cost, and that they were not the super limbs of TV cyborgs and superheroes. As the reality of clumsy, if constantly improving, artificial limbs became clear, I continued to anticipate the day that physical, technological transformation would become a reality for the average consumer, even as I began to worry about what that would mean for those who embraced it. As I grew older, I was drawn to stories of augmented humans. Mamoru Oshii's film adaptation of Masamune Shirow's cyborg police procedural, Ghost in the Shell, was an especially impacting experience, and opened the door to the apparent obsession of Japanese popular culture with artificial life, robotics, and the computerization of society. I was coming of age at a time when technological development was beginning to outpace its popular depiction. We are now at a time where these fictional bionics appear almost quaint next to emergent technologies. The United States Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, in collaboration with non-military researchers, have recently demonstrated a prosthetic arm that uses a technology called targeted muscle reinnervation to allow amputees to control it intuitively as they would with a natural limb. The technology can also be used to provide sensory feedback, allowing amputees to sense contact with a missing limb. Replacement limbs aren't the only significant development that mirrors science fictional augmentation. Google's recently released Google Glass is a wearable computer interface whose optical display evokes the digital readout seen by Arnold Schwarzenegger's time-traveling cyborg in The Terminator, and it looks not unlike the visor worn by LeVar Burton on Star Trek. Though it is an external device, the practical development of Google Glass suggests a plausible future in which ocular implants could provide totally internalized, hands-free communication, image capture, and enhanced visual analysis. Imagine walking down a crowded main street, GPS information guiding you in real time to a coffee shop. You place a remote order for a latte. Walking through the door, facial recognition software immediately picks your friends out of the crowd. the beverage you ordered is waiting for you. You don't drink it right away, as the visual temperature display shows that it could still burn your mouth. You sit down to talk books. As you chat about your latest literary discovery, you transfer a copy of the text to your friends. You immediately pull up excerpts and annotations for discussion. As fanciful as this sounds, it is by no means out of the realm of plausibility. The eagerness with which the public would embrace such an omnipresent and dangerously exploitable technology, however, remains to be seen. And what would come next? How far might we go in augmenting ourselves, rebuilding ourselves? Will a time come when we can abandon our meaty shells entirely? When, like the ship of Theseus, we replace each component until we are entirely synthetic? A transferred consciousness encased in plastic and metal? Would we still be the same vessel? Would we still be human? Could the aspirational drive that defines our species allow for our transcendence beyond it? Proponents of so-called mind uploading are confident that such an existence is a natural endpoint for personal augmentation, a virtual immortality as we transition to a form that can be maintained indefinitely. Current hypotheses suggest that it may be possible to copy an entire brain pattern into an artificial medium. Critics caution that, even if we were to achieve such a thing, the result would merely be a duplicate mind, not a continuation of consciousness. Here, it seems, we may have our answer to the paradox. The ship may continue on long after its last original piece has been replaced. But the crew must inevitably die.
You've been listening to Pioneer Radio. Our show is produced, edited, and hosted by Kelly Jones, Margie Taylor, April Clyburn-Sharon, Mark Conrad, Andrew Forbes, and Andrew Vowles. For more, visit pioneerradio.wordpress.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Waiting for me when I lose my wallet and my keys. You say that they should send me back to the reformatory. I think you just want to see me as a Catholic schoolgirl with the skirt to bare my knees. How eccentrically you love. Take a nap or take a trip down to the sea. I'll come be bored to how eccentrically you love. But we are strangers too, though I know you through and through. And we're always talking, but are we really saying anything? We're saying everything, so how can we be anything but? You over worry. You feed me lunch as though I'd waste away. I'm getting skinny. How
how my mouth betrays me when I dig into the plates you buy me. You like to see me hungry, how eccentrically you love. I'm always lending you things I can't spare, things I need. I broke my house apart to build a fire so everyone could see the bones of how we lived. Though the ashes stir me sadly, all that's left is yours, how relentlessly we love. I take my time on you, 'cause we're the kind of people who deserve the long view. We're always talking, but are we really saying anything? We're saying everything, so how can we be anything? But we're always talking, but are we really saying anything? We're saying everything, so how can we? My time on you, 'cause we deserve the long view. I take my time on you.